Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning, April 27th, 2019. How are we doing this morning? Sunny here in Southampton, some clouds, a little on the cool side, but the rain that we had yesterday, boy, the rain, the thunderstorms, oh my goodness. It is a gorgeous morning, thank goodness, on this Saturday, and I'm so glad you're joining me. Where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. You can hear us from anywhere online at 883wppb.org. Kyle Lynch is here with me in the studio. Sky, our golden retriever, is at my feet here. I hope he's a good boy this morning. He's a little hyper this morning, but Sky loves coming to the studio. All I have to do is mention Kyle. And he can't wait to get in the car. Anyway, good to be back in the studio in Southampton. And this morning, we have two super achievers and fascinating personalities in the world of golf who will be joining us. And if you're not a golfer, you will still enjoy hearing these interviews. All of you going to the PGA Championship at Bethpage this week, or the week of May 13th. We'll probably pass through the merchandise tent, either on your way in or on your way out, and you're bound to see the artwork created by Lee Rabransky. Lee is the official artist for the 2019 PGA Championship, as well as many other major championships. Last year, Lee enjoyed just a career year. He created artwork for the U.S. Open. In fact, we visited with Lee last year on the show. And he had some of his artwork showing right here in town at the Southampton Cultural Center. Last year, he created artwork for the Open Championship, the PGA Championship, the Ryder Cup in Paris. His posters have become highly collectible. His originals are owned by tour players, including Jordan Spieth, Justin Rose, Rory McIlroy, Graham McDowell. So Lee Rabransky will be joining us to talk about this year's artwork for the PGA Championship, which will be at Bethpage Black. And you all know the warning sign there. The Black course is an extremely difficult course, which we recommend only for highly skilled golfers. Talk about intimidation, right? To see that sign. So we'll visit with Lee and what goes into creating these posters for all these major golf championships. And in the second half of the show, Ward Clayton will join us. Ward is a producer for a film documentary that's called Loopers, The Caddy's Long Walk. And this, I'm telling you, is a beautiful film about golf, the history of golf, but mostly focusing on the caddy profession. Some of you have caddied. Some of you are still caddies. Some of you have been caddies your whole life, your whole career. Most of you know caddies. This film charts the history of golf from its origins in Scotland and focuses on the caddy, a most important part of the game. Traditionally, the saying about caddies has always been show up, keep up, and shut up. But this film shows through historic footage, interviews with everyone from Nick Faudo to Tom Watson and so many caddies who have made a name for themselves, who have helped their tour players win major championships, that the caddy acts as a player's psychologist, best friend, technical advisor, confidant. So I look forward to talking with Ward Clayton about this stunning film that he is a producer for, and it's making the rounds as we speak at film festivals all over the country. Well, last week I took this Saturday show off, but, you know, I had attended the Masters, covered the Masters. I was there for 10 days, starting with the coverage of their inaugural Women's Amateur. And the final round of the Women's Amateur was staged at Augusta National on the Saturday prior to Masters Week. And I have to say, that tournament could not have been better. It must have exceeded, you know, their wildest expectations. Jennifer Kupcho won a Wake Forest senior. She won with a score of 5 under 67. She birdied 5 of 6 holes on the second nine. The TV ratings were great. It was the highest rated amateur championship ever. And it really was just an excellent showcase for the top women amateurs in the world. And so it started out the week on a high note. And of course, Tiger Woods' epic comeback win, his fifth green jacket, his 15th major title. What a way to close out the Masters. What a final Sunday. I mean, Tiger used patience. He used smarts to win. He held steady, parring the 12th hole, while so many others so close up the leaderboard didn't use enough club with the wind that picked up, dropped their tee shots in Rae's Creek on number 12. Meanwhile, Tiger played it safe. He hit to the left portion of the green, two putt for par. Then he went on to birdie 15. He birdied 16. He went to the 17th tee box with a two-shot lead. He ended up bogeying the 18th, but he won by one shot. And this was 11 years after winning his last major title, 14 years after winning his last Masters. It's been a truly remarkable comeback. I've been covering Tiger since he started playing professionally. Through all his injuries, through the four back procedures, Tiger admitting literally in the fall of 2017 that he wasn't even sure he'd ever play again. So I've been through the ups and downs with Tiger Woods. I've been critical of him through the years, but to see his transformation as a person in the last year and a half has been quite remarkable. On an interview that Tiger did with Golf TV, he said that a big part of his victory at the Masters was actually hitting draws right to left with his driver. He knows that he no longer has the length that allowed him to hit three wood off several tees there, which, you know, if you hit three wood, it's easier to actually control the ball. So now with the PGA Championship a couple weeks away, you know, who's picking Tiger to win it, to win back-to-back major titles? I don't think that's going to happen, but then I did not pick Tiger to win the Masters this year either. Any number of players can win it, just like we saw at the Masters. Even Tiger said, look, any number of players could have prevailed at Augusta National. So many strong players were so close. And there is some Tiger news. He has decided to skip the Wells Fargo tournament at Quail Hollow in Charlotte, North Carolina, coming up this week. His agent, Mark Steinberg, said he's not ready to go next week. The Masters took a lot out of him. He's not hurt, but he's being smart. And so Tiger is giving his body a break from tournament play until the PGA Championship, which I said starts in a few weeks. He has to rely on his knowledge of the course, strategy, consistency. He won the U.S. Open when it was played at Bethpage Black in 2002. He said he's not starting to devote hours to working on his game yet, but he has started to think about it, the PGA Championship, in preparation. Brooks Koepka is a defending champion, having won the PGA Championship in St. Louis just this past August before they moved the major from August to May. You know, there's so many guys who could win it. Dustin Johnson, Tommy Fleetwood, Rory McIlroy, Francesco Molinari, Justin Thomas, Ricky Fowler, Jason Day. Any of these guys can win the second major on the calendar. So it should be very, very exciting. Let's see. In other sports news, well, rest in peace, John Havlicek. Sad news. One of the greatest players in basketball died this past week at the age of 79. He played all 16 of his NBA seasons with the Celtics, winning 8 championships, including one in each of the first 4 seasons of his career. Only 2 players, Celtics teammates Bill Russell and Sam Jones, have won more championships in NBA history. Havlicek had been suffering from Parkinson's disease. In college football news, Dabo Swinney, who coached Clemson football to 2 national titles in 3 years, he signed a 10-year, $92 million deal yesterday. $92 million for a college football coach. It is the biggest contract in college football history. It's even bigger than the $74 million 8-year deal that Arizona football coach Nick Saban has through to 2025 and the 10-year $75 million contract that Jimbo Fisher signed with Texas A&M through 2027. The Virginia Cavaliers, the winners of this year's NCAA men's basketball tournament, will not be going to the White House to celebrate with President Trump. Head coach Tony Bennett tweeted on Friday that with several players either pursuing pro opportunities or just moving on from UVA, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to get everyone back together to go to the White House. The 2018 winners of the NCAA tournament, the Villanova Wildcats, did not go to the White House either. The Clemson Tigers, however, who won the college football championship in January, they went to the White House already, where they were served fast food from Wendy's, Burger King, and McDonald's. Remember that story? And the Baylor Lady Bears, the winners of this year's women's NCAA college basketball tournament, have accepted the White House invitation. Let's see. We'll end with a surfing story. How's that? Two Americans won surfing events in Australia. All you surfers out here on the east end of Long Island. John Florence won the men's event after fellow American and 11-time world champion Kelly Slater was eliminated in the quarterfinals. Courtney Conlogue took the women's competition. It was held at Bells Beach World Surf League Stop. All right. Yay for surfing. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk a little art, golf art, with none other than Lee Wybranski and then Ward Clayton in the second half of the show. We'll talk about a beautiful film called Loopers, The Caddy's Long Walk. Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry, D-U-N-E Jewelry, and the Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, P-E-A-K Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. We're on safari to stay. Tell the teacher we're surfing USA.
Tune in to Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Socklow every Sunday at 11 a.m. on WPPB, coming to you from Estia's Little Kitchen in Sag Harbor. Join us in a free-flowing conversation with different people who cast their own long shadows across the Twin Forks and beyond. Sundays, 11 a.m., only on WPPB, Long Island's only NPR station. Find us on Facebook at Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Socklow.
Hi, it's John Landis for the Jam Session Radio Hour. For years, we have come to you from Bay Burger in Sag Harbor. We've moved to a new location, Union Cantina in Southampton Village, where you can still join us Thursday nights at 7 for 2 hours of great live jams. Come join us for the Jam Session Radio Hour here every Wednesday evening at 7 on Peconic Public Broadcasting, Long Island's only NPR station, WPPB 88.3, and stay tuned for the best in local public radio.
Join us, won't you, for Radio Deluxe. I'm John Pizzarelli. From high atop Lexington Avenue in the Deluxe living room, along with Jessica Mulaski, we host a show that is great talk and wonderful music. Join us this week, won't you, for Radio Deluxe.
Listen Sundays at 1 on 88.3 FM.
WPPB is working for you on the air and on our website. WPPB has an amazing community calendar on our site. Just go to 883wppb.org to the community calendar tab and tell us about your activity or event. It's free, easy, and fast. WPPB is the voice of the community, 365 days a year, 7 days a week on the air and online. Spread the word about your community events. Go to 883wppb.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Edwards, host of Sock Hop Saturday Night, heard from 8 p.m. until midnight right here on WPPV. Great oldies from the 50s and early 60s. Rock and roll, rhythm and blues, doo-wop, along with your request and dedication. 4 solid hours of music and memories with me, Mark Edwards, right here on WPPV, 88.3 FM, Long Island's only local NPR and public radio station.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this sunny Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. You can hear us from anywhere by going online at 883wppb.org. And you can hear this show on podcasts, and it's archived on my website at annliguori.com. And joining me now, legendary artist Lee Wabransky, who is in Arizona, so he's up bright and early for us. Good morning, Lee. Welcome to Sports Interview.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Are you awake?
I am. I'm on my second cup, so hopefully I'll be coherent here.
Well, about a year ago, June, you were right here in Southampton. I remember going to see some of your artwork displayed at the Southampton Cultural Center, right?
That's right. We had a big show in conjunction with the U.S. Open last year at Shinnecock. It was a lot of fun, and certainly enjoyed visiting you in your studio.
That's right. You were here in person. Well, I'm glad we could get you on to kind of preview this poster that you've created for the PGA Championship, Beth Page Black. And was it tough? I would think not, based on the characteristic of the black course. But how tough was it to come up with an idea for this year's poster?
Generally, it's not too difficult. These types of projects, when you deal with a course that's iconic as Beth Page Black, that people know so well, and there's a few holes on the course that everyone recognizes. But we did, working with the PGA of America on the poster this year, we did decide sort of halfway through the creative process to take a left turn, so to speak, and focus not so much on the course itself, which is kind of my typical approach, and focus more on the fact that Beth Page was going to be hosting the world's greatest players for 2 huge events, this year's PGA Championship and then the 2024 Ryder Cup. So working with the PGA of America, we decided creatively that it would be fun to create a product that really showcased the dual events coming down the road at the Black. And we'll see. Hopefully the public likes it. I think there's going to be a few other images in the merchandise tent that focus on the course. So the idea was to do something that would stand apart.
I mean, can I talk about it? Because I'm looking at a copy of it that you sent me, and a lot of people have that sign. I know I have that sign, that warning sign, hanging up in my garage.
Yeah. I think a lot more people are going to have it after this month. But, yeah, the warning sign is, everyone just loves it. It's kind of, there are certain sort of iconic things in golf. I mean, people love the Marion logo, and people love the warning sign at Bethpage. So we'll see a lot of it. But, yeah, it was fun to work with. I had done a little work. We had made a replica warning sign for the 2009 U.S. Open there 10 years ago. So I certainly was well-versed with it and very familiar with it. And you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, sort of. It's something that really captures the formidable nature of the Black course and also, you know, tickles the fancy of, you know, anybody who's ever played there. So you can't argue with that, really.
And you've been all over the place at golf courses, as have I, and I can't recall any other golf course that has a warning sign, you know, similar. I mean, this sign, for those of you just tuning in, the Black course is an extremely difficult course, which we recommend only for highly skilled golfers. Talk about, you know, being intimidated when you, you know, you're playing Beth Page and that's the first thing you see about the Black course. I mean, that kind of gets sticks in your head, and it is a very, very difficult golf course, no doubt about it, with a lot of elevation. But have you, in all your travels, ever kind of come across a sign similar?
I can't think of anything even remotely similar in the world of golf that I've encountered. It's a very jarring greeting when you're walking up to the tee, that's for sure.
It really is. So the fact that that's part of this art creation is a very good idea, I think, because it's so, you know, it's so much about Bethpage Black, that's for sure. Last year, you had a career year, Lee. I mean, you had posters when I saw you at the U.S. Open here. I saw mm-hmm. you at the PGA Championship. I saw you at the Ryder Cup outside of Paris. So it's been a 2018 probably was a career year for you, right?
Really was. We've been very fortunate. I've been, you know, working for the major championships for a few years now, but having the cherry on top last year being the Ryder Cup in Paris was a real treat. I mean, obviously the U.S. team didn't, you know, we didn't get the results that we were hoping for, but it was a surprisingly animated event. I didn't really know what to expect with the first, you know, the first Ryder Cup in France, and France not being exactly known as a golf crazy country. I can tell you that, you know, well, as you know, the vibe on the ground there was just spectacular. And the course, which I didn't know too much about, you know, before painting it, turned out to be a great match play venue. And, you know, I was staying just down the street in the shadow of Louis XIV's Palace of Versailles. So as an artist and an art historian, to be around all that was a neat treat, too. So it was a very, very special year.
Absolutely. I mean, it was so much fun to be there. Obviously, the American team didn't do well, but just the whole atmosphere and just to be in Paris, my goodness, was special. But how much in advance did you have to go to that golf course to, you know, to paint this the poster for that event?
You know, typically I go 6 months to a year out to visit the venue. Pardon me. But in the case of this, if you remember, that poster image was quite different than they wanted to do something sort of like the PGA this year, but the Ryder Cup wanted to do something a little bit out of the box in terms of the artwork. The poster tradition in France is very creative and a little bit more abstract maybe than, you know, what Americans are used to. So long story short, I ended up not visiting the course in advance because the aerial view of the finishing holes with sort of the dual island green that I ended up rendering in the poster was such that it, you know, it really didn't. It was a view from up in the air, so it didn't really require me to get on the ground over there. So my first view of the course in person was actually when I showed up to work the event, which is very atypical for my, you know, my creative process. But it worked out well.
Wow! So you painted? Did you paint it from photographs? Is that it, or?
I actually painted it, yes, with a combination of images that was supplied by the client, as well as. You know, working with Google Earth and, you know, finding a very, you know, creating a, well, how would you say it, sort of a unique abstract composition based on, you know, based on the landscape as viewed directly from above. So it was kind of a neat combination. A lot of my work, you know, I think it stands out a lot because it's very obviously hand-done, but a lot of it does include or we incorporate a lot of technology into the artwork. It's just never what you see on the surface, so. I think this was a neat example of that. I mean, it's the first time I've ever really worked with imagery from Google Earth to create, you know, artwork. So it was a neat piece, and it went over very well. It's just a very different animal than, you know, what I would typically create for one of the major championships here in the States.
It's amazing what you can do now with technology, right? I mean, it's a whole different medium, I would think.
No one, you know, it's funny. I mean, feeling my age a little bit, but... you know, anything you need to, it used to be so difficult to find photo reference for things, you know. If you had to, you know, you'd be looking through old magazines or golf books or this or that. And now it's just such a luxury to be able to really find almost anything you want at your fingertips. And to me, as a working professional artist, that's one of the sort of the biggest advantages that has come my way via technology in the last 15, 20 years.
And I know your first golf course, your first client was Wingfoot Golf Club, and they're hosting the U.S. Open next year.
Super excited about that. I mean, I was thrilled when Wingfoot hired me back in 1996, I think. But to be working, I was literally in touch with the club yesterday in light of a couple of projects. We're doing some work with them. They have a centennial actually coming up in 23, so we're helping them with some of their graphic elements for their centennial, and then with the U.S. Open returning there next year, it's going to be a real thrill. Anytime as a professional that you get to sort of close a circle like that, it's a neat feeling. So to have started out my career in golf at Wingfoot and then to be coming back to paint it again 20 years later for the U.S. Open is a, it's pretty nifty synergy. It's certainly one of those goosebump moments that you're lucky enough to get working in this business.
You have a great job, I tell you. You're your East Coast guy, right, Lee? You started out in Philadelphia and then moved to Flagstaff.
Yeah, it's true. I'm a Philadelphia guy. I spent most of my life, with the exception of college, I grew up in the western suburbs and then lived in Center City for 20 years. My studio was right near Rittenhouse Square in Philly for most of that 20 years. So definitely have Philly in my DNA. To my surprise, I've been out in Arizona for almost 10 years already. So it's going to be nice to get home. I mean, the Bethpage is going to be a neat treat for me in that regard. I'll be visiting family and seeing a lot of old family and friends. Whenever I get back east for work, I try and schedule a few extra days to catch up with loved ones. So it's going to be a neat couple of weeks.
I think of Lee Rybransky with, all your art equipment out on a golf course. And I've seen photographs of you, painting on these incredible golf courses all over the world. Mm. Would you say you spend more time on a golf course painting, or would you say you spend more time in your studio in Flagstaff, Arizona?
Well, to my regret, I'd say I spend a lot more time in the studio than I actually do painting on the golf course. Getting out there and painting plein air on the course, whether it's, quietly during a non-event day or during the events, as I've done at Baltusrol and Belrive for a couple of PGA championships, it's a lot more fun and liberating to be out there, outdoors painting. But by and large, as a working professional with deadlines to meet, most of the work that I do is here in the studio. I'll go to the site, collect my sketches and photographs, and then, put it all together and try and make the magic happen here in the studio where things are a little bit more manageable in terms of working conditions and hours and things like that. So, I think you've kind of got a dream job yourself, Anne. I think you might actually spend more time on the golf course than I do.
That was my next question. Yeah, I love, obviously I'm blessed with what we do, but we don't play as much golf as people might think we do. We're very busy, right? Running a company and taking care of a lot of different things. But do you have time to play and do you wish you, if not, do you wish you could play even more?
I have a little bit of time to play, but it's just as you say. I mean, I don't know if it's like this around the country, but in the Northeast anyway, there was a cliche that if you love golf, stay out of the golf business. Because you're really, you're your busiest during the season. We don't have a year-round season up there, nor do I have a year-round season here in Flagstaff, where we have a pretty serious winter. So I don't get to play as much as I like. I try and scratch the itch. I like to practice. I took up the game kind of late in life, so I feel like the people who grew up playing as a kid just want to go out and play all the time, which I'd prefer to play, but I'm happy to sort of scratch the itch on the driving range and the practice green. So I try and get out a couple of times a week just to hit a few balls and keep the game sort of relatively playable. And then, I get around and I don't even want to say on the air how little I've played in the last couple of years, but that also has to do with having relatively young kids. So, hopefully we'll have a chance to play a little bit more in the coming years, but I love to play. I think playing informs my work tremendously, pretty much play every chance I get. So there you go.
I love to practice too. I'm the same way. I could just go to a practice facility and be on the driving range and work on my short game and putting like all day. I absolutely love to practice. Some people can't stand to practice, but it's very therapeutic. It's very relaxing to me. Last question, Lee. Before I let you go, is there a project? I mean, you've done so many of these major championships. Is there a project that you just really are dying to do that you haven't had a chance to do yet?
There's two things. I guess the short answer would be probably an event that you're very closely associated with, and that's the U.S. Open Tennis Championships. I'm a huge tennis fan also. We've done a little bit of work in tennis. I did the poster for the Miami Open last year. And I've always thought that tennis would be sort of a great extension of my portfolio. I think the work that I do, this my style, would lend itself to that. And the neat thing about the U.S. Open Tennis Championships, you know, to me, I mean, among the many sort of unique features is, you know, how urban it is. It's in, you know, one of the greatest cities in the world. And it's so young, so international, so fit. I just think, you know, it'd be a really fun event to do work for. So outside of golf, that's one I've sort of always aspired towards. And within golf, you know, it's not exactly a project or an event or anything like that, but I get asked often if there's a course that I'd, you know, love to paint that I haven't painted yet. And my, you know, it's a cliche answer because everybody knows it, but you could probably guess, man, if there was one of the most beautiful courses in the world in America, what would you call it?
Oh,
right up the street from Pebble Beach.
Oh, you haven't been to Cypress Point yet, huh?
Well, I've been there, but I've not painted it.
Oh, why?
So it's just, you know, I don't know. The stars haven't aligned. I mean, I'm fortunately a very, very busy person art-wise, and, you know, there's sort of not that many open spots in my production schedule every year because I do a lot of the same events, you know, annually. So we can only squeeze in a few new things. You know, that one just hasn't materialized yet. Last year, the new work last year was for the NBA All-Star Game and the spring and fall meets at Keeneland. So we did basketball and horse racing last year, and that took the spot. So I'm hoping that maybe this year when I'm out at Pebble for the U.S. Open that maybe I could, you know, make something happen in my my longtime Cypress Point aspiration.
Well, I think something tells me that will eventually happen in your career. Lee Bransky, thank you so much. I will see you at the PGA Championship in a couple weeks at Bethpage Black. Keep up the great work. And, yeah, I don't have any more wall space for all your artwork. So that's my only complaint. I love it so much. I just there's no more room.
Well, you have to rotate your collection. That's what I tell people.
That's a very good solution. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
It's been great talking with you, Ann. Thank you for having me, and I look forward to seeing you in a few weeks.
See you in a couple weeks. Lee Wabransky, the official artist for the PGA Championship, coming up at Bethpage Black. All right, we're going to take a quick break and talk to another colleague of mine in the golf world, Ward Clayton, who has done so many things in the media business, communications business, in the golf world. But his most recent project, he is a producer for a beautiful film documentary called Loopers, The Caddy's Long Walk. So we'll touch base with Ward Clayton in a few moments. First, let me tell you that Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and the Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune Jewelry, D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Peak Vision is P-E-A-K Vision. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. Peakvision.com. I'm dreaming of, you see, I can be myself.
The following is a public service announcement from WPPB. Are you caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's disease or related dementia? Could you use some time to yourself while your loved one is in a safe and stimulating environment? Day Haven Adult Day Services, now open in Riverhead, provides your loved one with a full day of activities while they enjoy the company of their peers with bi-weekly programs and breakfast, lunch, and snack. Learn more at dayhaven.org or 631-807-1720.
Tune in to Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Socklow every Sunday at 11 a.m. on WPPB, coming to you from Estia's Little Kitchen in Sag Harbor. Join us in a free-flowing conversation with different people who cast their own long shadows across the Twin Forks and beyond. Sundays, 11 a.m., only on WPPB, Long Island's only NPR station. Find us on Facebook at Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Socklow.
I'm Meg Noonan, inviting you to join me on Sundays from 6 until 8 p.m. here on 88.3 WPPB for my new show, Freeform Radio, where you'll hear a lively mix of rock in all its glorious subgenres, including but never limited to classic rock and roll, American and British blues, glam and garage, punk and new wave, indie, folk, and country, plus a heavy dose of soul, R&B, and more. So tune into Freeform Radio, where variety reigns supreme, every Sunday night at 6 on 88.3 WPPB.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Edwards, host of Sock Hop Saturday Night, heard from 8 p.m. until midnight right here on WPPV. Great oldies from the 50s and early 60s. Rock and roll, rhythm and blues, doo-wop, along with your request and dedication. 4 solid hours of music and memories with me, Mark Edwards, right here on WPPV, 88.3 FM, Long Island's only local NPR and public radio station.
Join us, won't you, for Radio Deluxe. I'm John Pizzarelli. From high atop Lexington Avenue in the Deluxe living room, along with Jessica Mulaski, we host a show that is great talk and wonderful music. Join us this week, won't you, for Radio Deluxe.
Listen Sundays at 1 on 88.3 FM.
You've got the best seats in the house for the greatest songs of the American Musical Theater. Hello, I'm your host, Larry Maslon, for Broadway to Main Street, here on WPPB. The curtain goes up every Sunday at 3 o'clock.
Broadway to Main Street, you us.
WPPB is working for you on the air and on our website. WPPB has an amazing community calendar on our site. Just go to 883WPPB.org to the Community Calendar tab and tell us about your activity or event. It's free, easy, and fast. WPPB is the voice of the community, 365 days a year, 7 days a week on the air and online. Spread the word about your community events. Go to 883WPPB.org. This is Long Island's public radio, 88.3 FM, WPPB, Southampton, New York.
Sunflower in the morning, standing in the garden. You wait. No power can compel you out into the daylight. Let that evil wait. Strange start upon the pillow. What day demands a day? Well, I don't know.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this sunny Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday from 9 to 10 Eastern. And you can hear us anywhere online at 883WPPB.org on podcasts. And each show is archived on my website at AnnLiguori.com. And joining me now is Ward Clayton, a producer for a beautiful film that I had the pleasure of watching yesterday called Loopers, The Caddy's Long Walk. And so delighted to say good morning to Ward Clayton. Hey, Ward, thanks for joining me here on Sports Interview.
And good morning to you. I'm glad it sounds like a nice day there.
Yes, thank goodness. It's spring has arrived, and I'm back in New York, and it's the day that I'm going to plant the pansies.
There you go. Perfect.
Which
perfect.
I look forward to every year around this time. But Ward, thank you. I know the film is making its rounds on, you know, in the film festival circuit right now. Thanks for letting me, you know, kind of take a look at it, because I'm so impressed. It's beautifully done from a cinematography standpoint. I love the way that you showcase some of the most, you know, beautiful, prestigious golf courses in the world. And the subject is about caddies, and it shows so much of the history of the game. There's so much about this film, and before we get into more of the description of it, how did you get involved with the caddy aspect of the game? Because I know, you know, you've done so much. You're a content director for Masters.com. I see you every year down at Augusta National. You have your own media communications PR company. You just do so much. You're an author. How did you get involved in really researching and writing about and producing this film about caddies?
This goes back to 2004. I had an interest when I was used to be the sports editor of the Augusta Chronicle newspaper. And when I was there, we always heard the stories of the famed old caddies at Augusta National and just knew their nicknames, like Iron Man and Cemetery and so forth like that. But we didn't know who they were behind that nickname. So I was intrigued by finding out a little bit of their background on this. So in 2004, I wrote a book called Men on the Bag, The Caddies of Augusta National, which talked about Jack Nicklaus's caddy, Willie Peterson, Iron Man, which is Nathaniel Avery, caddy for Arnold Palmer, and so forth. So wrote that book and had some success with that. And then about 4 years ago, I got a call from Jim Packer, who works for Lionsgate in L.A. And Jim is an avid golfer, has had a caddy, and wanted to do a documentary on caddies, and read my book and thought this was a chapter of that he wanted to explore. So therefore, we put our heads together, and 4 years later, we're putting this film out on caddies. So it's, as you can imagine, it's a dream come true. It's really cool, especially when you see your face on a screen about 20 feet tall. It's a bit scary.
Yes, you're interviewed in the film. You know, we see you throughout the film, as well as Nick Faldo and Tom Watson and Rick Riley. And, you know, there's so many different personalities who are involved with the game who talk about caddies. And of course, the caddies themselves. I just thought it was very well done. And so now, you know, it's good to know that you know, here's a Hollywood film director, right, who comes to you and says, I want to do this.
Yeah, that was really neat. You know, you get a cold call on anything you've done. You know, you probably get these calls, too, and you have to sort of weigh if this person's got the wherewithal or if they're legitimate or things like that. So it turned out to be yes, he was. So that was a neat experience dealing with these folks, and the film crew went to Scotland and Ireland and Pebble and Bandon and Augusta and all the Evans Scholars locations, and so it's a wide breadth on how caddies came to be in the UK and how they migrated to the United States and how they've gone from being sort of the guy who worked in the kitchen or worked in the barn into a very well-respected profession.
That's right. I said in my introduction that, you know, in the early days, and even today, you know, what was the saying about the caddies that I'm trying to find the quote here. They should basically, you know the quote.
Show up.
Keep up and shut up. That's it. Exactly. Yeah. And that's so kind of demeaning, right? Because so much goes into what a caddy does and so much training goes into what a caddy does that people don't perhaps realize that you have to be so smart about the golf course, about the equipment, about and so tuned in to the person you're caddying for. There's just, you have to be part psychologist, you have to be a technical advisor, you have to be, you know, a confidant of the person that, you know, you're caddying for. It really combines so many different aspects that not everybody can be a great caddy, for sure.
Yeah, one of the quotes in the film that really resonates with me is Mike Kaiser, who developed Bandon Dunes and has done some other golf courses and done quite well in life. Bandon was developed in the middle of nowhere, and it's a walking-only golf course. And he said that he wanted the caddies to be among the happiest people in his employment or who were at that resort. And you wonder why, and it's because the caddy spends more time at the resort with the guests than anybody. So therefore, the customer service, he wants the caddy to be the guy that conveys how great a place this is, how happy they are, and so forth. So I thought that was quite a perspective from him to make sure the caddy's front and center.
Absolutely. And then, you know, at Augusta, who was the gentleman who started the caddy program there and really started by bringing in local people who needed work. They needed money. And then he started training them not only about the game and reading the greens, but also about, obviously, course etiquette and how to deal with different personalities. I mean, that those are all part of the job.
I think that's the essential part, and hopefully it comes through in this film, is that it's not about pulling clubs or reading greens or doing things like that. It's how you interact with the person you're caddying with. And, you know, I'm sure you've had the opportunity to play a round of golf with a caddy. It really makes a round of golf almost like just a little bit of a personal journey with a friend. I think it's really a cool experience if nobody's ever played around the golf with a caddy. It really brings it to a new level.
And which caddy did you mention, if that's mentioned in the film, was the one that pretty much kind of started training other caddies? Was that Willie Pappy Stokes?
That was Pappy Stokes. Pappy caddied for 5 Masters winners, including Ben Hogan twice. Pappy was, his family lived at Augusta National's property before Augusta National was built. When the property was being built, he worked with the crews that were cleaning trees and plowing the land, and he watched it rain, and he watched the water flow down toward Ray's Creek and realized that everything broke toward Ray's Creek. And that little bit of intel holds true to today, and all the caddies at Augusta National want to get a little bit of knowledge that nobody else has, and they understand that on every green, there's a red dot on a marker in the caddy facility that shows the direction of Race Creek. So I guarantee if you go to the Masters and look in a caddy's yardage book, for example, Joe LaCava a couple weeks ago, I bet he's got that red dot on all of his little markers for his greens.
And for a long time, Pappy Stokes kept that knowledge, that information to himself, right? He didn't want anybody else to know that all those putts broke toward Ray's Creek, right?
Well, he shared it with some of the guys he tutored at Augusta National,
okay,
such as Carl Jackson. Carl and Ben would never share that intelligence. They would just keep that to themselves because they thought that gave them an advantage. I'll never forget, Carl told me once, this is in the film, that Bruce Edwards, when he started caddying at the Masters, would always come up to Carl and try to get some insight on what made the golf course, so you could learn the golf course better. And Carl would not share that with him because he was in the middle of Ben's heyday and Tom Watson's heyday. So therefore, they sort of kept that to themselves.
I love it.
One of the coolest things is you can take a timeline and go from Pappy Stokes to Carl Jackson, who worked with Ben Crenshaw, who won twice. And then in the later part of his career, Carl shared some of that information with Michael Greller, who caddies for Jordan Spieth. And, of course, Jordan won in 2015 at Augusta National and has been quite successful playing there.
Absolutely. And then you had Nathaniel Ironman Avery, who caddied for Arnold Palmer. And I love the story about when Arnie lost his temper at one point, and he went up to Arnie and said, "Are we choking?" And Arnie said, "You know, it felt like the caddy was my dad reprimanding me like my dad used to." I love that
exactly
story.
So Iron Man was famous because he was pretty stoic on the golf course, and Arnold was pretty flamboyant. But when they got off the golf course, Iron Man was famous for every time Arnold won, he would go buy a new car in Augusta.
Really?
And that's what he spent his money on. And one year, he won and was out on the town and totaled the car.
Oh, no.
And was injured in the accident. They took him to the local hospital. The doctor found out who he was and came in and said, "I'm sorry you lost your car." And Iron Man pulled the sheet back and said, "But I still have these." So he had a pair of brand new shoes on that he was showing. So he was excited to still have his shoes.
I love it. So then he got a number of cars. He got four. He was with Arnie for four of Arnie's green jackets.
Exactly, exactly. And the coolest thing we did in this film, and this is not in there, but it's still a byproduct of it. Iron Man died in 1985, didn't have a very good life after he and Arnold Palmer broke up in the late 60s, and everybody lost track of him. But he was buried in downtown Augusta in 1985, and for 33 years, actually, he was buried without a marker on his grave.
Oh, wow.
So we found, in the book I wrote, I noted that he was buried without a marker, and we went and researched it again and made sure that he was in, that it was indeed his marker, and an anonymous donor allowed us to put a marker on his grave in downtown Augusta. So if you ever go to Augusta and want to go to Southview Cemetery in downtown Augusta, you can find Iron Man's grave, and it notes that he caddied for Arnold Palmer and all four of his Masters wins.
That's a great story, Warren. I'm surprised that didn't make the film, but I'm sure you had to leave some stories out. But and then there's Willie Peterson, who caddied for Jack Nicklaus and caddied for, five of Jack's six Masters victories.
Willie is the exact opposite on the golf course of what Iron Man was. Willie Peterson was very flamboyant, and as if you recall, Jack was, deemed to be a slow player and didn't show a lot of emotion on the golf course until he won the golf tournament, of course. But Willie would go make wagers in the golf shop, and in the caddy shack with the caddies that Nicklaus was going to shoot 65. And some of the footage you'll see in this film is of Willie reacting when Nicklaus makes a putt or misses a putt or things like that. So with that little bit of knowledge that he's made these wagers, you understand why he's so emotional on the golf course. He's the only caddy to this day, I think, that's from Augusta has ever appeared on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
Wow.
When Nicklaus won in 1972, there's a picture of Jack holding his putter up, and there's Willie in the foreground holding up the number one, smoking a cigarette.
I remember that photo so clearly, for sure.
Yeah.
That's so amazing.
Willie was, if you were to follow around with Nicklaus, I'm sure that Willie was going to have some antics along the way that would make you laugh.
These stories are just so entertaining. And I have to ask you, because, I had the pleasure and the honor of getting picked in the lottery, the media lottery at Augusta National, to play the course three times. The very first time was years ago in the late 90s. And my caddy was a guy who worked full time in a morgue, which wasn't a good omen for me, playing my first time at Augusta National. The guy was so great. Would you have remembered who that person, you mentioned somebody nicknamed Cemetery. Would that have been him?
Well, Cemetery probably may not have been alive, or he was really old by that point in time.
Okay.
So, if I may, I can share the story of Cemetery's nickname. That may interest your listeners.
Sure.
Cemetery was a guy named Willie Pertit, and he was a little guy, and he somehow became friendly with President Eisenhower, and he was a member of Augusta National, so he became his caddy. Willie at night would play the drums in a jazz band in Augusta. Well, he took a liking to this young lady, and was with her for a little while, but then one weekend he decided he didn't like her anymore. So he was out playing the drums and came out of the gig and was leaving, probably 1 o'clock in the morning. And the young lady and some of her friends attacked him and injured him, and they thought that he was fatally injured and took him to the hospital. And the doctor examined him and thought he was dead and sent him down to the morgue. And when he was in the morgue, the mortician's down there checking him out and everything, and he woke up and scared the mortician half to death.
Oh,
so therefore, all of his friends and caddies at Augusta National called him Dead Man. That was his nickname. Eisenhower didn't care for that, so he changed his nickname to Cemetery.
I love that story. Oh, my gosh. But you wouldn't remember which one of those caddies spent most of the year working in a morgue, because that was the guy I had caddying for me at Augusta National in the late 90s.
But
it was wonderful.
Knowing their penchant for nicknames, I would guarantee his nickname had something to do with something he did other than caddying.
Definitely.
Because all those guys had nicknames that were generally descriptive of what they look like or something they did on the side.
Definitely. And I know there's been a number of caddies, and you can't remember every single one and their nicknames, but one particular story I'll share is on number 12, I had to hit a wood, you know, to it was windy that day, to get on the green. And it landed pin high but rolled into the bunker behind the 12th green. So this caddy went over to the other side and squatted down in front of Ray's Creek and put his hands, formed his hands into like a baseball catcher's mitt, and I hit it right into his hands from the bunker. And he did that to prevent it from going into Ray's Creek. So
we
had a beautiful day, and you know, he was just such a classic caddy. I have heard since he has passed on, but you know, it's so special there. How many times have you had the opportunity to play Augusta National, Ward Clayton?
When I was a sports editor of the Augusta Chronicle, every spring we had an opportunity to play in May. So
wonderful.
I got a chance to play 9 times. So
I love that. And what's your best score there?
78.
Nice. Very. Yeah. And who, I hate to say this, can you tell me who your favorite caddy is or was when you played? Who caddied for you?
I don't remember who. Well, when we played that, it was on media day, so we didn't necessarily have to have a caddy.
Oh, okay.
But my favorite caddy, Carl's my favorite caddy, just because, Carl Jackson.
Sure.
Just because Carl quit school at age 12 to go caddy to make money for his family. And later on in life, all 6 of his kids got college educations.
I love that story. That's awesome.
Yeah, so I think that really speaks a lot to Carl's dedication to working as a caddy and being successful, but, you know, looking out for his own family.
And, Ward, what was the year where Augusta National changed their policy that the players had to use a local caddy and they could bring their own? Wait, do you remember what year that was?
Sure, 1983. In 82, there were rumblings that was going to occur, and they had a rainstorm one afternoon, and play was postponed till the following morning. And the caddies at Augusta not all of them, got word of what time play was going to resume the next day. So therefore, there were a handful of guys that went out and played a couple holes without a caddy and had to tote their own bag. So, that was sort of the last straw, and Augusta National figured out that from the caddies had become a bigger part of the PGA Tour, and therefore they ought to allow their own caddies to come and caddy for players there instead of providing the caddies at Augusta National.
Well, I highly recommend people go and watch this documentary, Loopers, The Caddy's Long Walk. It's playing in Greenwich, right, coming up in June?
Yep, June 4th. Let's see, what day is it? Let me check here. Sunday, June 2nd, 5
right.
p.m. It's a Greenwich Film Festival, and that's greenwichfilm.org. Tickets go on sale May 4th, so you can go there. You can see it on Sunday, June 2nd, and then it's going to be in about 25 to 50 markets across the U.S. starting the following Friday, which is Friday, June 7th.
I love it. Well, we're wrapping up the show in a couple of seconds, but I would love it if you could get the film out here for the Hamptons Film Festival in October. I'd love that.
Let me know. We'll see what we can do.
Ward Clayton, producer for Loopers, The Caddy's Long Walk. So enjoyed talking to you. We could keep going because there's so much I want to talk to you about, but we'll have to do a part 2 in the future. Thanks so much for joining me here in Sports Interview, Ward.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend.
Thanks to Ward Clayton, Lee Wrabranski, Kyle Lynch, Sky, my golden retriever, who actually has behaved this morning. Have a wonderful weekend. Be safe, smile, be kind to one another. I will talk to you next Saturday morning from 9 to 10 right here on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori.